The following is an encore presentation of Wordland. Hello, and welcome to Wordland. I'm your host, David Oates. This week, we have a story from Bill Harley, a song from the Cowboy Poetry Gathering, poetry from Billy Collins, stand-up from Stephen Wright, a spoken word with music piece by Peter Weir, and John Mulaney's classic story, The Salt and Pepper Diner. Bill Harley remembers sixth grade.
Forget that girl, even though you find it's hard. Forget that girl.
This is a story about being cool and going steady. Two very important things. I went to Delaware Trails Elementary School. We learned a song when we were in kindergarten that you might want to hear so you know a little bit about the school I went to. The song went like this. Delaware Trails is a school for me, in Indianapolis, in the land of the free. We like to work, we like to play, we like to do things every single day. Delaware Trails School, best in the USA. We learned that in kindergarten, but I'm not talking about kindergarten because I'm talking about being cool. And in kindergarten, it doesn't make any difference if you're cool or not, but it does when you get to sixth grade. Two houses down from me on my street, there was a girl, and her name was Patty Schaefer. I was what we called at the time in Indianapolis, crushed out on Patty Schaefer. That meant I liked her a lot, a whole lot. I thought she was beautiful. She won all the blue ribbons at the Delaware Trails Elementary School field day and the 50-yard dash and the 600-yard run, and I liked her a lot, which should have been good, because she liked me too. At least, that's what all my friends told me, and all her friends told my friends. They said that she liked me, but I wasn't sure because I couldn't talk to her to find out for sure. The fact is, I couldn't talk to any girl at the time that I was at all interested in, because when I did, I'd just get all flustered and say something real stupid, like, "Hey, your teeth look real nice today." And so it was hard to talk to Patty. As a matter of fact, I couldn't talk to her at all. Now, what you would do if you were cool, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute, and you liked somebody and they liked you, you were supposed to go steady. Now, this going steady was always a little bit of a mystery to me. I never was quite clear what it meant. I knew some stuff about it because I'd watched people and I'd listened to them talk and I'd figured some stuff myself. This is really weird stuff we're talking about, going steady, some of the things you were supposed to do. For instance, one of the things you do if you were cool, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and you were going steady, is we used to wear these bracelets around our wrists. It was a chain bracelet, had a metal plate on it, and on that metal plate you had your first name, not your last name or your birth date or your phone number or address, just your first name. And you'd wear this. I'm not sure why. I think maybe so you'd know who you were when you were called on. You know, the teacher would say, "Bill!" And I'd look down, and my name would be there. And I'd say, "Yeah?" So what you would do if you were cool, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, is you would take this bracelet off, and you'd give it to the person you were going steady with, and they'd give you theirs. So you'd wear theirs, and they wear yours, which is a little bit weird when you think about it. Because when they call on you in class, "Bill," you look down, and you see you're not there. So you don't answer. Anyway, I knew that was one of the things about going steady. I mean, I knew you were supposed to carry books. I could do that, I figured. There was the problem of talking to the person you're going steady with, but I figured I could deal with that somehow, sometime. But the problem with going steady was talking. Because in order to go steady with somebody, you had to ask them. And in order to ask them, you had to talk to them. And that meant, if I wanted to go steady with Patty, and I guessed I did, I had to talk to her. And I couldn't. I wouldn't know what to say. I could hardly even look at her. Patty and I, we went to the same bus stop. It was in front of Scott and Margot Trusty's house. And I'd stand on one end of the bus stop in the morning, and she'd stand on the other waiting for the bus. I'd look down, see her go, and then the bus would come along. And I'd be one of the first ones on, and I'd walk all the way to the back of the bus and sit on the back bench, and Patty'd sit in the front. Actually, there's something about these buses that you should know. The buses that I rode on, they had one big long bench against the back. Some of you ride buses now, there's an emergency door between the two benches, but that wasn't always true. It used to be one long bench. I know why they stopped that, because we had a theory when I was in school that if we could get about 87 kids on that back bench, then the bus would just go whoop, stand on its end, and it would never get to school, which sounded like a pretty good idea to us at the time. And the bus companies got letters from the schools, and they stopped doing that, and they put an emergency door in there instead of making it one long bench. You might need to know that at some time, and that's why I'm telling you. But anyway, we'd ride to school, you know. I'd be at the back, and Patty'd be at the front. And three stops later, an incredible thing would happen. A boy would get on the bus who was in sixth grade, too. His name was Ted Wohlgemuth. And Ted would get on the bus, and he would walk all the way down the length of the bus and sit beside me, which was amazing. It might not sound amazing to you until you hear about Ted. You see, Ted was cool, and I wasn't. And now I want to talk for just a minute about being cool, everything I know about it. The fact is, I don't know hardly anything about being cool. I wished I did. It seemed like one day I showed up in my sixth grade class, and it was clear from the beginning who was cool and who wasn't. You know, if I had a list of everybody in my sixth grade class, right now, today, even though it was a long time ago, I could go down the list and tell you who was cool and who wasn't. The way I figure it is that they handed out one day in school a mimeograph sheet that had the four steps towards being cool on it, and if you were in school that day, you got the list, and you know how to be cool. And if you weren't, which I guess I wasn't, you didn't know how. So if I went down that list of kids in my sixth grade class now, I could say he was cool, she wasn't, he wasn't, she wasn't, he was, she was, he wasn't, she wasn't, she wasn't, he wasn't. There was a lot of kids that day that missed the sheet. Must have been sick. Ended up being not cool because they stayed home from school that one day. There was some other stuff about being cool. You had to wear the right clothes. Seemed like I was always a half step behind there. You had to hang out with the right people, but it took me a lot of time to figure out the right people. Anyway, Ted was cool, and I wasn't. He was a was, and I was a wasn't. And Ted would walk down the aisle, and he'd sit down beside me, which is unbelievable when you think about it. Because do you know what happens to somebody when they sit next to somebody? If they're cool and that other person they sit next to isn't cool, the person who's cool gets uncool. You could figure that out yourself. You're not stupid. So anyway, Ted would sit next to me, which was an incredible chance on his part, because what happened if people found out that he was sitting next to somebody who was uncool? So I was always very grateful to Ted, because I figured, you know, maybe me sitting next to him, our shoulders would touch and my left arm would get cool. I'd be walking down the hallway and somebody I didn't know who was cool would say, "Hey, Bill, nice left arm, pretty cool." I'd say, "Thanks a lot, yeah." Ted would sit next to me. And he'd say, "Hi, Bill." And I'd say, "Hi, Ted." He'd say, "How you doing this morning?" I'd say, "I'm fine." Then he'd say, "Hey, Bill, are you going to ask Patty Schaefer to go steady today?" And I'd say, "Well, I don't feel like it today. I think I'm going to do it tomorrow." And he'd say, "Okay." And then the next day, Ted would walk down the aisle. He'd sit next to me. He'd say, "Hi, Bill." I'd say, "Hi, Ted." He'd say, "How are you doing?" I said, "I'm fine." He said, "Are you going to ask Patty Schaefer to go steady today?" And I'd say, "I don't feel like it today. I think I might do it tomorrow." And then he'd ask the next day, and the next, and the next. This went on for weeks. It started in the fall. October, November, it went on into the winter. Went on for months. Every day he'd walk down the aisle. Hi, Bill. Hi, Ted. How are you? I'm fine. Are you going to ask Patty Schaefer to go study today? No, I think I'll do it tomorrow. On into the spring. All year long, every day he asked me. Until one day, he came down the aisle. It was a spring day. I can see him coming down the aisle, wearing a light blue jacket. His mother must have bought it for him the day before. It was a new jacket. Must have been bought from the right store. Ted looked cool coming down the aisle. His hair was combed right. He did everything right. He was cool. He sat next to me. He looked at me. He said, "Hi, Bill." I said, "Hi, Ted. How you doing?" He said, "I'm fine." He said, "Are you going to ask Patty Schaefer to go study today?" And I said, "I don't feel like it today. I think I'll do it tomorrow." And he said, "Bill, do you know what?" And I said, "What?" He said, "You are a chicken." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You're afraid to ask her. You're not asking her because you're afraid to ask her." I said, "That's not true. I just don't feel like it." He said, "You don't feel like it because you're afraid. You're never going to ask her." I said, "That's not true. I'll just ask her when I feel like it." He said, "You're never going to feel like it. I got an idea." "What?" I said. "Why don't I ask her for you?" Ted said. Now right away, a red flag went up in my brain that there was something a little bit unusual about this. This was not the way things usually went when you went steady. Although I didn't know much about it, it seemed a little unusual. I said, "I don't know, Ted. It sounds a little bit weird to me." He said, "No, it's not." And I said, "Are you sure it's cool?" Because remember, Ted had the mimeograph sheet and I didn't. And Ted said, "Sure it's cool. I mean, you like her and she likes you. I'll ask her. It's all right, and then we'll find out." I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Yeah, I'm happy to do it." I said, "Okay." Ted said, "Great." And then he stood up. And I looked up at him and I said, "Oh my God, he's going to go ask her right now. I thought this was going to take place at some future date in 1996 or something." And then Ted put his hands to his mouth and he called out across the bus, "Patty Schaefer!" Now, I don't know what kind of bus you all ride, but the bus I rode generally had hundreds and thousands of kids on it. Kindergartners, first graders, second graders, third graders, fourth graders, fifth graders, and us. And the one thing you did not do on Mr. Anderson's school bus, Mr. Anderson was the bus driver, was yell, which Ted did. And so when Ted said, "Patty Schaefer," it got dead quiet on the bus. And I said,
"Uh-oh."
And Ted said, "Will you go steady with Bill Harley?" And hundreds and thousands of faces turned and looked right at me. And I almost fainted. My face grew pale. I slunk down on my knees and sat on the bus floor. I pulled my jacket over my head and I called up through my coat, "Ted, you jerk! What did you do that for?" He said, "You wanted me to ask her." I said, "Not in front of all these people." He said, "Don't worry, Bill. They're just kids. You know, kindergartners. They don't understand anything." "Great," I said. "The whole world heard and they don't understand." He said, "Don't worry, it's fine." But that didn't help me. I sat on the floor of the bus with the coat over my head all the way into school another 15 minutes. And I sat there when the bus came to a stop outside the school. And I sat there as all the other kids stood up and they scuffled off the bus. I could hear their feet as they got off one by one. And it got quiet. And I tell you what, I just wanted to die. I wanted them to find my body on that bus, not recognize who I was, and bury me there under the playground, under the swing set, tomb of the unknown student. I wanted to die because I had never been so embarrassed in my whole life. And all I could think of was that all the time, Patty hadn't even turned her head. I sat there on the bus for a long time, and it was awful quiet, and I was beginning to think, Maybe this is what it's like when you die of embarrassment. Maybe I'm already dead. When I heard the big seat. The bus driver's seat. And then I heard the footsteps. Huge footsteps coming down the aisle of the bus. It was Mr. Anderson, the bus driver. Mr. Anderson, he was a little bit over 4 foot tall. About that wide, too. I have no idea how he saw over that big wheel. He was that short. He was bald on top. He had steel-framed glasses. He was always dressed in green. He had a big belt. I mean, it was big, because it was bigger than he was. As big as he was, it still had 7 or 8 notches left that hung down to his knees. He had on old work boots. Looked like they were about 65 years old. I never understood how anybody could have boots that looked that old, that hadn't fallen apart. And Mr. Anderson, I think for 6 or 7 years in a row, he had must have won the Indiana State Bus Driver of the Year award because he was such a good bus driver. I told you he didn't like it when people yelled. No, he didn't. Some kids yelled on the bus and they were never seen again. And Mr. Anderson had eyes in the back of his head. I'd never seen him, but I knew they were there because he didn't have a rearview mirror that other bus drivers use when they look up and see kids throwing stuff at each other. I'd have an eraser in my hand, about to throw it across the aisle. He wouldn't even look up from the wheel. He'd just say, "Put it down, Bill." Caught in the act. You didn't mess with Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson knew that there was something living on his bus. He didn't even count. He just sensed a presence. Boom! 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 Down the aisle. Boom! Till the footsteps stopped. And I could feel through my jacket over my head his eyes beating down upon me. Looking at this huddle saying, "What is this?" Looked at me for a long time. And then I heard his voice say, "Going to school today?" Sounded like there was some room for negotiation. I lifted up my coat a little bit and said, "No?" He said, "Oh, you gotta go to school. It's good for you."
"Not today, it's not," I said. "It's just not good for me today."
He said, "Come on, get up." He yanked me up by the arm. He kicked me down the aisle, kicked me off the bus. He said, "You're gonna have a good time."
I said, "No, I'm not, Mr. Anderson. I want to come live in the bus yard."
He said, "Get going." Closed the door with the handle. Set off on the bus, left me standing out in front of the school,
trying to decide what to do, because I knew by this time the whole school know. They'd probably made an announcement over the PA system before they did the Pledge of Allegiance that Bill had been too chicken to ask Patty, and Ted Wolgamuth had done it for him. And I walked down the hallway, ready for some little kindergartner to come out the door and say, "Bill and Patty!" And I would have strangled the kid right there, been put in jail for the rest of my life. I walked down the hallway. I sat in my 6th grade class. I kept turning my head, trying to catch somebody snickering at me, because I knew they were. But everybody in Mr. Revis's class that year was awful fast. That's why they were in Mr. Revis's class. Even if they weren't cool, they were fast. And I sat there in Mr. Revis's class, waiting for something to happen. Patty, she was in Miss Toon's class. We called her Miss Tuna Fish. We thought that was pretty funny. Patty was in Miss Toon's class, so I didn't have to look at her. I sat there and waited. I waited. We went out on a recess, came back in. We had lunch, another recess. I sat there waiting for something to happen to me, because you know what it's like when you've done something or somebody's done something and you're going to hear about it. You're waiting for everybody to find out. You're waiting for the word, and I waited, and I didn't hear anything until the very end of the day. And Sue Martin, Sue sat behind me. Now, I know this sounds weird, but as a rule, I could talk to Sue, even though she was a girl, because she sat behind me. And when there's a girl that sits behind you, somehow they're not a girl anymore. They're just a human being, and you're able to speak to them. At least that's the way it was with me. I could talk to Sue. She was my friend. She sat behind me. May have been a girl, but she was a human being in that instance. And she said to me, "Bill?" I said, "Yeah, Sue, what do you want?" She said, "I talked to Patty Schaefer at lunch today, and something inside me said, 'Bill, be cool.' And I wished I had the mimeograph sheet, but I tried." I said, "So?" She said, "Ted Wolgamuth asked her if you wanted to go steady with her." "So?"
She wants me to tell you that she doesn't want to go steady with anybody now, but when she does go steady, she'll go steady with you.
Oh, I said.
Now, I knew right away this was a little bit of a weird answer. I was hoping for a yes or a no so I knew where I stand. But it wasn't a yes or a no. I mean, it was a yes in that it meant that she really did like me. But it was a no because we weren't going steady. And while I was trying to figure out if it was good or bad, I realized that if she'd said yes, I would have had to talk to her. And I would not have known what to say. Sue said to me, "But Bill?" "Yes, Sue." "If you want to go steady with somebody, you can go steady with me." I turned around and I looked at her. I said, "You?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "But Sue, I can talk to you." She said, "I know." I said, "Yeah, but if I went steady with you, then I wouldn't be able to talk to you and we couldn't be friends, and I like being friends with you." She said, "Bill, that's weird." I said, "I know, it's just the way I am." She said, "Forget it. Just forget the whole thing." I said, "Okay." Because my head was still in a fog. You know, I didn't know what to think. School ended. I got on the bus, one of the first ones on. Mr. Anderson said, "Have a good time today." I didn't know what to say to him. I just nodded my head, headed to the back of the bus, sat in the back seat. Ted didn't sit with me. I guess he hadn't come home that day or something. I sat at the back seat, and I looked out the window, trying to figure out what I was supposed to do, and I saw Patty get in the front of the bus, and I didn't know what to do. The school bus pulled out, and kids started throwing stuff at each other until Mr. Anderson ate them. And I got home. Patty got off the bus, and I got off the bus 50 yards behind her, and I walked home behind her without saying a word. Now, the fact is, I hardly ever spoke to Patty again. I admired her from a distance of 2 houses, might as well have been 50,000 miles, always liking her, but never able to talk to her, wondering when she was going to be ready to go steady and if she was going to come up and ask me the next time. And when we got to 7th grade, we went to the junior high school. It was a big school with billions of kids. Kids got lost in there and were never found. And one day, one evening, my friend called me up and he said, "Hey, Bill." "Yeah?" "I thought you might want to know that Patty's going steady with Richard Kautzman." Richard Kautzman, I thought to myself, starting halfback on the 7th grade football team. I didn't have a chance. He said, "I thought you might want to know," and I said, "No, I don't really care." And I hung up the phone, and I went to my brother's room, and I got out his Monkees record, and I took it to my parents' record player downstairs in the basement, in our rec room, and I put it on, and I listened to the second cut over and over and over again, until my parents probably thought either the record player was broken or I was. It was Mickey Dolenz, and he sang it over and over again.
"Forget that girl, even though you find it's hard. Forget that girl. You know what? I never did."
Bill Harley, "Forget That Girl," from his Tales from 6th Grade. The Cowboy Poetry Gathering has a different idea of poetry than, say, the American Academy of Poetry, but some lovely stuff.
Lost 45 horses to Geronimo's men. They caught me sleeping when they snuck in. It's gonna be hard to explain this one. All I can say is the Apache won. Running ponies make a cloud of dust. lit out for the border Mexico bus, singing victory songs in the pale moonlight. If I had me a horse, I could give him a fight. I lost 45 horses to Geronimo's men. The boss of this spread is as mean as sin. All I can do to make amends is find 45 horses and Geronimo's men. And Geronimo's men. And Geronimo's men. Trail when the sun came up.
Yeah.
Crawling on my belly like a young wolf pup. 3 days later, had the camp in sight. When I caught a flicker from the corner of my eye. The bullet started kicking up that desert sand. No use running, I got only to stand. Put my lasso around a pony, pulled up the slack. I pulled down the corral and stole those horses back. I stole 45 horses from Geronimo's men. The boss of this spread is as mean as sin. All I can do to make amends is find 45 horses and Geronimo's men. And Geronimo's men. Geronimo's man. And Geronimo's man. Yeah, and Geronimo's man.
All right, Butch and Ernie. Thank you very much.
Geronimo's Men by John Chandler with Butch House and Ernie Martinez from Elko! A Cowboy Poetry Gathering, 2005. Speaking of the American Academy of Poetry, here's former poet laureate Billy Collins reflecting on creative writing workshops.
Writing poetry has always been one of the great solo acts. You know, you do it by yourself, or I suppose any form of writing, until the advent of the poetry workshop. Now poetry is a kind of semi-pseudo-collaborative effort in some cases. Philip Levine said that the poetry workshops could be described as one of the fastest growth industries in America. And I teach them or conduct them or whatever you insinuate them. And I decided to write about the phenomenon. In poetry workshops, wherever they're given, similar comments are made. There's kind of, a limited number of things you can say about about poetry, and that number is quickly exhausted in some cases. It's called workshop. If it had one of those 19th century subtitles, it would be maybe in which the author bites the hand that feeds him. But it's... for now, it is just workshop. I might as well begin by saying how much I like the title. It gets me right away because I'm in a workshop now, so immediately the poem has my attention, like the Ancient Mariner grabbing me by the shirt. And I like the first couple of stanzas, the way they establish this mode of self-pointing that runs through the whole poem and tells us that words are food thrown down on the ground for other words to eat. I can almost taste the tail of the snake in its own mouth, if you know what I mean. But what I'm not sure about is the voice, which sounds in places very casual, very blue jeans, but other times seems standoffish, professorial in the worst sense of the word, like the poem is blowing pipe smoke in my face, but maybe that's what it wants to do. What I did find engaging were the middle stanzas, especially the fourth one. I like the image of clouds flying like lozenges, which gives me a very clear picture. And I really like how this drawbridge operator just appears out of the blue with his feet up on the iron railing and his fishpole jigging. I like jigging. Jigging a hook in the slow industrial canal below. I love slow industrial canal below. All those L's. Maybe it's just me, but the next stanza is where I start to have problems. I mean, how can the evening bump into the stars? And what's an obligato of snow? Also, I roam the decaffeinated streets. At that point, I'm lost. I need help. The other thing that throws me off, and maybe this is just me, is the way the scene keeps shifting around. First, we're in this big aerodrome, and the speaker is inspecting a row of dirigibles, which makes me think this could be a dream. Then he takes us into his garden, the part with the dahlias and the coiling hose. Though that's nice, the coiling hose. But then I'm not sure where we're supposed to be. The rain, the mint green light, that makes it feel outdoors. But what about this wallpaper? Or is it a kind of indoor cemetery? There's something about death going on here. In fact, I start to wonder if what we have here is really two poems, or three, or four, or possibly none. But then there's that last stanza, my favorite. This is where the poem wins me back, especially the line spoken in the voice of the mouse. I mean, we've all seen these images in cartoons before, but I still love the details he uses when he's describing where he lives, the perfect little arch of an entrance in the baseboard, the bed made out of a curled back sardine can, the spool of thread for a table. I start thinking about how hard the mouse had to work night after night collecting all these things while the people in the house were probably fast asleep. And that gives me a very strong feeling, a very powerful sense of something. But I don't know if anyone else was feeling that. Maybe that was just me. Maybe that was just the way I read it.
Billy Collins, Workshop, from The Best Cigarette album. Stephen Wright probably didn't write these in a workshop.
I saw this old lady wearing a full-length fur coat, and I went over to her. I said, "Excuse me, ma'am, what kind of animal is that coat made out of?" She said, "Raccoon." I said, "My God, he must have been huge." I borrowed some albums from a friend of mine. I was going to record them onto tape cassettes, so I had the wiring all backwards on my stereo and accidentally erased all his records. Gave him back these black blank things. Whenever I fill out an application and it says, in case of emergency, notify, I put doctor. What the hell is my mother gonna do? I can levitate birds, but nobody cares. It's a good thing there's gravity, otherwise when birds died, they'd just stay right up there. Hunters would be all confused. Sponges grow in the ocean. That kills me. I wonder how much deeper the ocean would be if that didn't happen. Woke up this morning, I was folding my bed back into a couch. I almost broke both my arms because it's not one of those kind of beds. I like to aggravate the salesman when I go into a store. Can I help you, sir? Yeah. Do you have anything I would like? He says, how do I know what you would like? I say, you started this. 24-hour banking? I don't have time for that. So I was driving my car around, decided to hook my brake lights up to my gas pedal. Just to confuse the people behind me. I hit the gas and the brake lights go on, they stop and I'm gone. They say, what is he driving? A friend of mine has a car phone, he has an answering machine on his car phone. The message is, hi, I'm home right now. So I can't come to the phone. But if you leave your name and number, I'll call you when I'm out. Whenever I pick up someone hitchhiking, I always like to wait a few minutes before I say anything to them. Then I say, how far do you think you were going? Put your seatbelt on, I want to try something. I saw it in a cartoon, but I'm pretty sure I can do it. I don't have a child now, but when I do have a child, I'm going to buy one of those strollers for twins. I'm going to tell him he was a twin, too. You were a twin, and your brother didn't listen to me. Thanks a lot.
Stephen Wright, mostly one-liners. Peter M. Weyer is going to take us on a ride. Thank you.
It was a reflection that spoke to me. As she lay sleeping beside it, the train heading from Brooklyn, we crossed the Manhattan Bridge. Passing like ghosts into the city. It was a reflection in the glass that opened her eyes to look at me, and with a glance at her sleeping echo, gave kind of a smile and raised a finger to her lips, as though to say, "Shh, don't wake her." Then resumed her position and closed her eyes. Every night I sit here. How many years have passed? I see her still, passing through a station on a different train. I keep looking. Now you'll find me here, reading too many signals. The train is rolling on deep beneath the city. There's a rain on the streets above. Canal, Spring, Union Square, Grand Central, all the way up to Spanish Harlem. Keep looking. We attach meaning to events, but events happen in the universe, and meaning happens in the human heart. I believe in miracles. The journey of souls on the 4 a.m. train. I'm hearing voices. An archangel on the roof of the Woolworths. Subway car. It's my reflection that speaks to me. A ghost stares back with haunted wide eyes, and I realize the road of the living is among the dead. We are the great river of shades. Year after year, night after night, I travel in this car. Until the ghosts of dawn arrive. The train stops at Delancey, wearing the tired eyes of an old man, clinging to his stick, stare through space at something no one else can see. I smile back at him.
Stories from the City at Night, Peter M. Weyer. Many practical jokes seem nasty and not at all funny. This one, though.
I want to tell you one story. This was the best meal I've ever had in my life, all right? This happened when I was 11 years old in Chicago, Illinois, where I grew up, and it took place at a little restaurant called the Salt and Pepper Diner, which was a family restaurant in the city. Yes, yes, you know the Salt and Pepper Diner? It's a wonderful family restaurant in Chicago, which means that it caters mainly to teenagers and homeless schizophrenics. Now, I go into this place one day when I'm 11 with my best friend, John. And I should say that his name is also John. I'm not calling myself my own best friend. It's a separate human being. We walk into the Salt and Pepper Diner one day, and they had a jukebox there, all right? And the jukebox was 3 plays for $1. So we put in $7 and selected 21 plays of Tom Jones's What's New Pussycat. And then we ordered and waited. Here's the thing about when What's New Pussycat plays over and over and over and over and over again. The second time it plays, your immediate thought is not, hey, someone's playing What's New Pussycat again. It's, hey, What's New Pussycat is a lot longer than I first thought. And it has like a dip in the middle. You know how some songs have a dip, like Guns N' Roses, November Rain? You're like, hey, November Rain's over. No, it's not. There's more. The third time it plays, you're thinking, maybe someone's playing What's New Pussycat again. The fourth time it plays, you're thinking, whoa. Someone just played What's New Pussycat 4 times. Or at least, someone played it twice, and it's a really long song. So, the 5th time is the kicker. Now, we're watching the entire diner at this point. Most people have gotten wind as to what's going on. And we're staring at this one guy, and he's sitting in his booth, and his, like, hand is shaking while his stupid kids jump around, and, like, he's been onto us since the beginning. And he's staring at his coffee cup like this, and he has this look on his face like, aw, like he just got his 30-day chip from anger management. And he's staring like this, and the 4th play fades out. It's dead quiet. And then, I don't know if you know this, but the song begins very subtly. Bwah, bwah, What's New Pussycat? And the guy goes, damn it! And pounds on the table, and silverware flies everywhere, and it was fantastic. But a word about my friend John and what a genius he was. Because when we were first up at the jukebox, and we were punching in the What's New Pussycats, right? I'd punched in about 7. And then John says to me, hey, 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 wait. Before we drop in another What's New Pussycat, let's put in 1 It's Not Unusual. And that is when the afternoon went from good to great. After 7 What's New Pussycats in a row, suddenly... Dum da dum dum na 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 na. It's not unusual, and the sigh of relief has swept through the diner. People were ecstatic. It was like the liberation of France. You know, for years scientists have wondered, can you make grown men and women weep tears of joy by playing Tom Jones's It's Not Unusual? And the answer is yes, you can. As long as it is preceded by 7 What's New Pussycats. And on the other hand, when we went back. Holy. It's it's not unusual, fades out. It's dead quiet.
Was new pussycat? People went insane. No one could handle it. No one could handle it. And they were surrounded by this, like, seemingly indifferent staff, you know, that was just like, yep, same as always. My only wish is that one of the schizophrenics had stood up and been like, now you know. Now you know what it's like to live in my brain. They unplugged the jukebox after 11 plays. And that was the best meal I've ever had. Thank you very much, San Francisco. This was great. Thank you. Hope to see you again real soon. My name's John Mulaney. Have a good night.
John Mulaney, the Salt and Pepper Diner, from his album The Top Part. The Reverend Billy C. Wirtz is fighting a block.
All my years of listening to the blues, it seems like I've heard a lot of songs about love gone wrong and going to jail and being out of work and hard times. So I decided to write a song about having the blues because none of those things happen. Well, my baby won't quit me. The doctor says, you're okay. People, how am I supposed to get the blues when everything keeps going my way? Policeman pulled me over and he said, hey buddy. Oh, it's my fault, please excuse. Yeah, good luck just keeps on following me. And people, I just can't seem to get the blues. I got home not long ago. There was a note tacked on the door. Said, I'm gone, but I'll be right back. Just had to run down to the store. She got home 10 minutes later. And I said, woman, where you been? And then I said, baby, please don't go. You gotta help me, girl. She said, just shut up and help me bring the groceries in. People, life can be frustrating when you're just not born to lose. The gypsy woman gave me my money back and said, son, I just don't think you're gonna get the blues. Let's get him on the piano here one time. Thank you. I went down to the local juke joint. People, I was ready to jump and shout. Told the man, we gonna pitch a wang dang doodle. He said, what the hell are you talking about? Walked up to a woman at a table. I said, look here, I'm a M-A-N man. She said, no, you're a G-E-E-K geek. I said, wait, no, don't kick me out. You don't understand. Just like when John Lee's mama told his papa. Mama told, no, wait a minute. Papa told mama. Even that part, I get confused. Yeah, my mama had him and my daddy had him. And my sister had him and my brother had him. And my aunts had him and my uncles had him. And my gerbils had him and my goldfish had him. And even my 400-pound ex-wife, Roberta, used to get kind of mad when she'd want to play the great love goddess meets little Mr. Squishy. And I'd say, Roberta, you're going to get away before you're going to hurt me anymore like that. And you can bet that Goliath looked down there and little David holding that rock in his hand and said, you better put that rock away before they have to pull it out of your... Oh, sorry. And people... Right. And people, I just can't seem to get the blues.
The Reverend Billy C. Wirtz, Just Can't Seem to Get the Blues, from Confessions of a Hillbilly Love God. That's our show. So this is David Oates saying goodbye, and thanks for listening to Wordland. Wordland is a Monkey Sound production recorded in the studios of WUGA. If you have questions or comments, please call your radio station or send email to dvdoates@aol.com. That's dvdoates@aol.com.